Vodka O'Clock.
Hey everyone, welcome back. It's Amber Love from Vodka O'Clock Podcast and AmberUnmasked.com. Don't forget we are labeled as an explicit website and podcast. And welcome back to the show, Jeremy Holt, who is amazing, and I'm so glad that he enjoys returning to Vodka O'Clock.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So, we have so much to catch up on. It's good. It's good that it's been such a great, productive year for you, and you're connected to like so many of the same people. So, it's just funny that when we're on Twitter and stuff, we're often in the same conversations.
It's a small community like that.
It is. I went back to check the show notes to figure out what it was that we were talking about last time, and it was about After Houdini and Challenger Comics, and, you know, now you've got new stuff coming out. So give us a rundown of where we left off with After Houdini.
After Houdini, the first issue debuted at Heroes Con in June. Kevin and I have been hard at work working on the second issue. We did release a full color version, I'd say maybe 2 months ago, which has been good. We're just trying to work through the second issue. It is challenging because Kevin does have a day job, and I think he was under the weather for a while, which, you know, it happens. And
Sick days in comics.
Totally. And like he does, and he actually manages a liquor store. So when I think something happened along the lines of several employees quit or something, so he kind of had to do a bunch of double shifts and, you know, just general life getting in the way of comics kind of thing. And we just spoke actually yesterday, and I think he's back on track. So not really sure when the second issue is going to come out. I'm hoping before the end of the year. We received some interest from a major publisher. Haven't received any commitments from them, but it definitely was positive. So we'll see.
That's really great news. I'm so happy to hear that. It was a really fun story. I mean, you took something that's iconic and created like this, you know, new generation, and at the same time made all of these ties about, you know, Harry Houdini that were worth exploring. So that was really cool. It's a good story.
Thank you.
And you've got Pulp, which is the next title out, which was like so different than your other work that I saw when I read that like a few nights ago. I was like, wow, it's not what I was expecting.
Yeah. That story, it's kind of funny because the artist Chris Peterson, who more or less co-created the book with me, we've been talking about working on this book for at least a year. And I was actually inspired to do a one-shot after I had read Kurt Pyre's LP, which was a really well-received one-shot he did last year. I believe Multiversity Comics did a whole piece on it and how much they loved it. And then I read it, and it was really the first one-shot I had read from an independent creator that not only did I know this person, but I became a huge fan of his work, and I was like kind of geeking out over somebody I actually know and have a friendship with. So I also saw the legitimacy of doing a one-shot, like telling a story beginning, middle, end in one issue, because as an independent creator, it's so much easier to sell a book at a convention or just to the general public if they get all of it in one go.
I agree.
Yeah, and I was struggling with that because I did several shows this year, and you know, I had first issues of several series that I'm writing, and it was always kind of awkward when, you know, someone come to the table and they want to buy a book, and then they'd ask inevitably, when's the second issue coming out? And to not have an answer to that is just, it's so demoralizing. So I was like, I need to try to just, as a writing exercise, try to tell a story, something that's engaging, something that someone would want to reread, and kind of want to hold on to it. So I had this idea for Pulp, which is kind of a noir type story, I had this idea for it one night, and I couldn't go to sleep. So the next day, I literally outlined, scripted, and revised all of it in about, I'd say, 10 hours. And it was done. I was like, there I go. There's my one shot. I accomplished it. Now I just need to find an artist. And Chris and I were talking about working on something, and I sent it to him, and he really liked it. But then, you know, Chris got very busy with a Dark Horse book he's working on. So the schedule of having it come out, I think we wanted it ready for Emerald City. That came and went. And then wanted to have it ready for Heroes Con. That came and went. So I was like, oh, maybe I'm not going to get to work on this. And Chris finally was like, you know, I'm going to do it. We're going to have it for New York Comic Con. And I was like, are you sure? Because New York Comic Con's a week away. Like, I haven't seen anything from you. Not that that's
the deadline,
but that's a week. I mean, that's a lot of work, man. Like, you don't have to kill yourself over this. We can just release it later. It's not a big deal. And he was like, no, I want to get this done. So I'd say in the span of 3 solid days, like all-nighters, he did a 24-page comic, which he penciled, inked, colored, and lettered in like less than 4 days. And, we had it for New York Comic Con, and then I was just sending it out to reviewers, and we were both really surprised with how well it's been received. And
his art is magnificent. I mean, just to give people sort of a visual, if they've never seen any of the previews or reviews about Pulp yet, it's very Darwin Cook Parker series. Where the illustrations have a bit of a sketchiness to them, and then very distinct, like duotone colors, where it's not, you know, you're not talking about like a full color. It's just so interesting because it's like old Playboy illustration styles.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it was because did you work together before because or something? Because somehow I was following him on Twitter because of you mentioning him or something, and I didn't know.
Yeah, we had worked together on a 5-page short story that ran in the back of Curtis Weeb's series Grim Leaper for Image.
Okay.
He allowed 5 people to contribute 5-page short stories that were kind of in line with the theme of the series, which is a love story to die for. So. I had written a 5-pager that kind of, there was a big debacle with the original artist, and Chris stepped in, and again, he delivered within a week, and we got the pages to Image on time, and they approved it and went to print. So that's when we first worked together, was last summer, I believe. And yeah, the style was something that we debated for a while, and, you know, his work on, B-Vixens, which is the Dark Horse series he's doing with Alex DeCampi, is a more realistic style, and it's cleaner lines, but he really wanted to do something, as he refers to, as cartoony. I don't think it's necessarily cartoony. I think it's maybe more complex than that. But he wanted to do that because of the mature content of the story, because it would just be that much more jarring when you see what makes this story a mature content story. And I think it totally worked. And it is impressive that he did all of this in 3 days, because when we read some of the reviews, a lot of people say, you know, Chris's work is so refined and like, and he kind of laughs because he's like, I did that in like 3 days. And I was like, I know, that's crazy.
Just amazing. Was it you who just said on Twitter something about what, you know, hey writers, what you need to do is just find an artist that makes you look mind blowing or something like that?
Yeah. Actually someone else posted that, God, I'm forgetting who posted
that. I forget who said that, but I was just like, retweet.
It was Joey Esposito.
Oh, there we go, yeah.
And I was like, yeah, absolutely right. That's what we're here for. We need to stand in the shadow of our artists because they do amazing work. I was really nervous about the story because there is a twist at the end. I knew that the twist worked in my head when I wrote it, and I've reread the script since then, but seeing it on the page, I was really kind of nervous to kind of see it play out, And I thought it worked, and I was really nervous that people were not going to get it. And when I was reading reviews, they were saying, oh, I had to reread this three times, and I was like, oh, my God. But they were like, I read it three times because I knew the first time I read it, it was something good, and I just wanted to figure it out. And by a third read, you're like, whoa. And one of the best compliments I've seen a couple people say is that when reading it's not something that you read, it's something you experience.
That's which pretty amazing.
Yeah. Which.
But I felt the same thing. I did go back, like, you know, when I got to the end, I went back to, you know, a certain number of pages and, like, and flipped through them again. I was like, okay, now I'm piecing this together. Because it is a bit of, like, you know, solving the mystery.
Yeah. And, yeah, and that's what I wanted, because I wanted something that someone could kind of, you know, revisit, not because they were, you know, want to get their money's worth, but because they really want to figure it out. And you know, it's a tricky balance, and I really didn't think I could pull it off. But I guess reviewers have proven me wrong, so it's been nice. A nice surprise.
So when you're working on a script, do you... Well, let me, you know, maybe a better question is to put it this way. Do you automatically find artists, know you want to work with them, and then come up with a script suitable to them, or do you just write out the stories because you feel like you really have something to say and then find your artist?
I work in both those ways. There are stories that I feel I have to absolutely write, and I do, and it's a matter of pitching that concept to an artist. But a lot of the times, you know, there are artists that I want to work with, and I, you know, ask them, you know, what do you want to draw? And That's how After Houdini came about, because Kevin and I had been working for a while and on projects I'd written, and he just wasn't feeling it, and he was just kind of not really producing any work, and I just could tell he wasn't excited. So I said, what do you want to draw? And he's like, I love Harry Houdini, and I have an idea, but I don't have a story. And that's how I started doing all this research into Houdini and came up with the concept. And but Pulp was one of those things that I wanted to write for myself, and I really wasn't expecting anyone to draw it. It was really just a writing exercise. And I think it was a good exercise for Chris too, to see, his output, like to see what he's capable of. And, you know, I think it really, it's a confidence booster for him, because, you know, he spent, you know, again, 3 days on a 24 page comic, and it's top quality. So, you know, he knows that, oh, if I'm given a month, I can produce something that is absolutely top quality, not something that he's questioning. So yeah, it goes both ways for as far as me scripting things.
So when you're working, I mean, obviously Chris did this amazing turnaround of 3 days, and you hadn't seen it, but is that normal for you, or do you normally go through a longer process of getting concept art and character sketches, and, you know, or is it just... you just know and have so much faith that you just turn it over?
Typically, if I've never worked with someone, I would want to see layouts. I'm not really married to my script, so if an artist, you know, changes layouts or adds a panel or removes a panel, I'm typically very flexible on that. So I'll usually see, you know, concept sketches for the characters, and then layout, rough layouts, and then tighter pencils, and then I just let them, if they want to ink it, I just say, just go for that. But with Chris, having worked with him before and knowing his style, and he'd sent me a couple sketches earlier in the year, and because I really just wanted the story to get made, I just totally just trusted him. I was like, look, just do whatever you want with this script. Like, if you want to change things, if you want to add things, just do it. I don't mind. I trust you. I know that your work's good. I know that, you know, you've been thinking about the story. Because he was telling me that his process, which I thought was kind of interesting, is that he was doing a lot of layouts as far as the spaces. Because Pulp takes place basically in two different locations, and that's it. So it's pretty minimal from that. So he was really spending more time on the physicality of the layouts. So because there are only two locations, it can get kind of monotonous for the reader. So he was basically figuring out exactly the dimensions of the rooms, the layouts of the house, the office, because it takes place in a cabin and in a high-rise office building. And he wanted to figure all of that out so he could use as many different angles as he could to keep it visually interesting. But yeah, then I totally trusted him, and everything he was sending me, I was just like, perfect. Yep, that's great. I have literally no notes. So,
is it a similar process when it comes to the color art as well? Do you just have a hands-off style?
I've only worked with a handful of colorists. With Chris, he was going for that dual tone to kind of just separate the different. Because this pulp is taking place in two different periods of time, I just let him do his thing. And really, I mean, I do have a formal art background, so I tend to be a little bit pickier with colors. But then again, I'm no expert. So, you know, I've the colors on After Houdini, I absolutely love. And, you know, I've had some friends of mine that have read it, and they're like, oh, colors don't really speak to me. And it's like, oh, you know. I mean, it is subjective. I mean, with colorists, I let them kind of just work, because as long as it's not if it just doesn't fit the artwork. Because, you know, I've sent pages to colorists that do test sample, just one page, and it's very clear to me and the artist when we're looking these samples over, like, which one fits the story and the tone that we're going for. So,
well, with pulp, you have it set. Is it supposed to be a very specific 60s time period, or is it, okay? Yeah. I wasn't sure if that was just, you know, maybe an homage to it, or if it actually was supposed to be set there. Where do you find just your fandom for, you know, following that? Because, like, I love this stuff, too. And like I said, I mentioned Darwin Cook's Parker series from the Donald Westlake stuff. And yet I don't watch Mad Men. I don't watch I don't watch Magic City, or what was the other one? Boardwalk Empire.
Boardwalk Empire, yeah.
I don't watch any of that stuff. And yet, for some reason, when the comics come out, I'm enamored. So, do you have particular fandoms?
Yeah, I mean, I get inspired by various TV shows, though. I mean, I am a fan of Mad Men. And when I was coming up with the concept, it was, to me, just more visually interesting to set it in that time period. And I must have been binging on Mad Men at the time, but I also wanted to kind of infuse kind of a Twilight Zone type twist, I suppose. I guess visually sometimes it's very clear to me what I want, and other times it's more vague, and I'm kind of open to an interpretation from the artist. When I was writing pulp, I knew I was going to have to try to eventually pitch it to somebody, so I needed to come up with, like, you know, an elevator pitch. And the best one at the time, I think I said something like, it's Mad Men meets Misery. And I think that, you know, it kind of boils it down. It's kind of a mashup of two very specific ideas and genres. So, I mean, with the time period, there were specific things I wanted to add, like the typewriter, because the story focuses on a writer. And I think the typewriter helps situate the reader in what time period. I mean, there are some people that still use typewriters, but there are other things I don't know if people really picked up on, like the coffee grinder is very of the times.
I noticed the coffee grinder mainly because I know people who specifically use it today.
Really?
Because they sense that the coffee for them tastes different.
Oh.
So they use it's interesting. It was one of those things that I noticed with detail was that coffee grinder.
Oh, very nice. Awesome.
So, I mean, but, you know, but like I said, I know people who use that sort of thing today, and, you know, old school, you know, hand grinding your beans like that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was also, you know, I mean, the story's about a writer, and it's about, when isolation meets with obsession and what that kind of does on the human psyche. And, you know, any of my friends and including you that write creatively, like, you do isolate yourself, and it it can really play on certain emotions. And I read this really great article recently that Jim Zubkevich wrote about in the creative field, especially in comics, when jealousy can really be detrimental to your process.
That was a phenomenal post.
Yeah, and he's right. Like when you're isolated, you know, you can. It's very intimate what you're doing, producing work that, you know, speaks to you and creating things that you hope, you know, resonate with people. And then when you see everybody else around you doing things and getting things published and, you know, having all these, you know, interviews and reviews coming out, and it can be very frustrating. And I think that... yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I wanted to write about it with Pulp, was just that feeling of isolation and how reality can kind of shift. When you're by yourself, you can kind of convince yourself of things when you don't have other people to kind of bounce ideas off of or just talk with, which I think that's what I miss about the podcast I used to do with Ryan K. Lindsay and Curtis Weeb was, you know, we talk about comics and the process of comics, but really we just enjoyed talking out frustrations or you know, certain fears we're having about certain projects, and, you know, just venting with another person is just so helpful.
Definitely. You get, whether it's, you know, the feeling of having a couple beers with your friends or coffee or whatever, it's, you know, at least we can connect at Comic Cons and with Skype and all of these things to sort of have that time, that social interaction that we really need. Because I remember in Stephen King's On Writing, he talks about his office, and he talks specifically about, because his book is called On Writing, and yet there's very, very little of it that's technical about the writing process. But he does describe things like his office, and when he wants to play the loudest thrashing music, because it dulls out the rest of the world and he can focus, or when he closes his door at times, and there are other times when he has it open. And it, and I hear that a lot. And it's one of those things where so many writers talk about how they just want to be in a cabin in the woods away from everybody. And I just, that sounds good to me for a little while. And I mean, a very brief while, like a few hours. And then I think I would go insane.
You know, it's funny that you mention that, because since I've relocated from a very bustling city that is New York to a quiet town in Vermont, I will admit I have become much more productive because there are fewer distractions. But as soon as I lose steam and I'm not producing anything, I just get very I go a little crazy. I get a little squirrely. I could be in the house all weekend and not notice. There's the trade-off, like, to have this time, to have the quiet. I mean, I have my own office now, which I've never had in my entire life. So that has been helpful to just kind of, when I walk through that doorway, I know that it's work time and I'm going to produce some stuff. But at the same time, it can be very lonely and isolating.
Danielle Steele was another writer. Actually, she's probably the first one that I remember reading some sort of interview where she had this. You know, I mean, she has, like, I don't know, a dozen kids or something. It's just, whoa. It's crazy. I don't know. She's got, like, a ton of kids. And she just talked about how she, you know, when it was work time, she'd go into her office and close the door. But talk about somebody who can't possibly be lonely, you know, it's like, it seems impossible. And yet, when I had a really nice apartment out in Pittsburgh, and it was, you know, so there was a completely different kind of neighborhood than my home now. I mean, like, my home, I'm away from everything. Like, you have to get in your car to be anywhere. And in Pittsburgh, I could walk to places, and I had close neighbors, and it was an apartment, so there were neighbors all over, and a really charming little area, and yet I felt so much more alone there than I do out here in the country.
Interesting.
I don't know what it is. I don't know, I've got, I don't know. It's, well, plus I'm not living alone, so that's a big, huge part of it. But I can remember just, like, being in that apartment with my cat and feeling like I was going mad, completely mad. And that's when people talk about how they need to isolate themselves to be productive. I'm like, how? I was like in a, I felt like I was in a 24 hours a day panic attack because I was, I was like me and the cat and you know. Oh,
well,
my God.
When you're writing, do you prefer to be like in a public space, like a cafe or something?
I can probably do either. But I've only tried that a few times because I'm trying to remember where I might have even done that. I mean, I've tried it in a bar and I've tried it in maybe okay. like a Panera,
yeah,
or something. And the hardest part is the interruptions of people. Like I'm okay with the noise aspect, even if I'll, you know, put earbuds in so it's a more dull.
Sure.
But it's a strange thing that when even if you have earbuds in, that people will still try to talk to you.
Oh.
Like, are you not aware that I'm not interested in a conversation right now? Like, I've been in conventions where I've, you know, literally my face is either in a notebook or on my phone. Because I'm, you know, maybe taking notes about something, or I'm live tweeting an award ceremony or something like that, and somebody's trying to talk to me. I'm like, do you not see how, like, I feel like I need a light above my head that just says busy, and it blinks in red neon letters.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, like, what I try to do, and I don't know, this might sound silly, but...
silly is perfectly fine.
Well, I make sure that the characters are interesting because I'm spending time with them. And if I'm not interested in the characters, then who's going to want to read the story? And that's what can help me when I'm sitting down to write to tune out the fact that, oh, I'm gonna spend the next 8 hours alone. And when I get into the groove of a script, I don't think about that. I don't even notice the time. But you know, it can be hard to kind of get into that headspace. And that's what I've spent most of this year trying to figure out is just a routine that I can depend on because eventually I'd like to assume I will be writing full time and I need to know that I could produce work when I need to produce it. And I've gotten a really good handle on that.
That's pretty cool. Are you a day person or a night person?
You know, I used to be a huge night person. It was so that I would stay up till, you know, 3 or 4 writing because, you know, that's when the internet is quiet and I can be distracted so easily by the internet.
Oh, yeah, me too.
And, you know, the relationship I was in at that time, it took a toll because my ex-girlfriend was really upset about me spending all the time writing late. And then, you know, I'm now... in another relationship, I'm engaged, and my fiance, I think it was like the first week she moved in with me, she was like, so this late night writing, it has to stop. And I kind of freaked out because I was like, whoa, is this a deal breaker? And I realized no, like I can figure out how to make it work, and yeah, I'm not a slave to a certain schedule. Like, you know, I'm gonna need to figure out how to work when I can because, you know, I have a day job now, so it's like I have limited amount of time to write. So you just have to make what works for you.
Yeah, it's actually one of the best pieces of advice that I ever got was from my friend James Hannon, who's one of the members here at the Star Wars costume group, the 501st Legion.
Okay.
And he's also an author, and he wrote his book on his lunch hour at his job. And, I mean, he had a challenging, you know, stressful office job, and that's what he did. Was he just knew that when he got home, it wasn't gonna necessarily be done, and you know, trying to figure out, well, you know, can I write at night? Can I write before I even get to work in the morning, or what can I do? And for him, what worked was making sure he guaranteed himself a break at work, and he wrote then, and he said, even if it's crap, you just got to do it. And so that's actually when I write now, because I know I'm not productive at night. I'm just not. I'm tired.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the last couple of nights I've been starting to fall asleep at 8:30. So I know what my productivity is, and I'm a day person. So, you know, in between my work tasks, I'll just have my document open. There are days when my document is open all day and I never look at it.
Sure.
Some of that's out of laziness. Some of that's just like, well, mood didn't strike me. I was on Twitter. but other times it's like, oh, okay, my document's open. I'm just going to go back. And it'll be one sentence at a time, literally one sentence here and there. And, you know, and another bit of inspiring information was Ian Broom is a podcaster.
Okay.
And he writes, he hosts a show called Write for Your Life. And his mother-in-law is a children's book author. And that's what she said she did. She would keep a laptop open on the dining room table or something. And he didn't understand how she ever got a book done. And she said, like, basically, whenever she walked past her computer, she would write one sentence.
Oh, my God.
And I'm like, how do you keep a train of thought that way? But, yeah. It, you know, I guess it worked, and it kept her mind fresh. So, I, you know, hearing other people's processes and stories, to me, is motivational, and other people might not be that way. They might just say, oh, well, what works for me works for me, and they don't care. Mm-hmm. But to me, I like to know that there are these other ways of trying something, because, hey, I might find something better that works.
Yeah, and it's being receptive to adapting or revising your process. I mean, I remember the first couple of years I was writing, I was adamant about writing outlines in a notebook with a pen. Like, the whole longhand I was, like, super proud of. I'm like, yeah, and I could sit down and focus, and I wasn't distracted by, you know, the internet. And I eventually just completely gave up on that when I was realizing my outlines were tighter and better structured on the computer, when I could just delete things much faster and reorganize thoughts much faster. And so I completely abandoned a process that I thought I was going to stick with forever. And because of that, you know, I could script a 22-page issue from outline to a first draft in, you know, 2 days. So, you know, it's been super helpful just to be, you know, not thinking there's one way to do it.
And I think what's changed, at least for me, as far as working on a computer like that instead of in a notebook, because I do also like to write notes, but I've abandoned it as well for the most part, unless I have nothing else. But it's having cloud services and things like, you know, Google Drive.
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter whether I'm on my phone or whether I'm at my, you know, desk job or whether I'm home. I know that my document is someplace I can get to it.
Exactly.
And that makes a huge difference in, you know, my process anyway.
Yeah. And you know, when I think about how I used to outline in a notebook and to have to transcribe it all onto a computer, it was just such a waste of time. Like, and yeah, for people who have busy lives and they're not always, you know, can write conveniently, having access to your document anywhere is great. I mean, I do miss writing in a notebook, like on the subway when I was commuting to work, or writing in a bar. Like, I would never bring a computer to a bar. That would just be awkward. But writing in a notebook, I like that because it's very versatile. I could do it anywhere. But now it's like, I know when I can be most productive. I know if I sit down and just write out the outline. The outline is the heavy lifting for me. Once I get an outline done, the whole process of scripting is much faster. But
oh, I agree completely.
Yeah. And it's crazy because I have some friends that don't outline. And I'm just like, I don't understand how you script anything. I don't know how you pace anything. I don't know how you do the page turns, because I couldn't write a script. I used to, and the scripts were not very good, but outline. It's all about outlining for me.
It definitely is for me too. And even when it comes to prose work, I need to have it worked out. And Robert Kirkman is one of those people who doesn't. He is.
That's crazy.
I'm like, but you, how? Look at your body of work. How you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I guess some people have it. Maybe they're, I don't know, maybe there's a way that they can analyze brains and figure out how it works differently for some people. I need structure.
Yeah, me too.
you know, I know some writers insist on having a post-it system or something like Scrivener where you have, like, virtual post-its, basically. It's in software index cards, and you work stuff out. And I even bought that, and yet, you know, I tinkered around with it for a couple of hours. And, you know, maybe I need a class in it because I'm like, okay, I don't really get why this would be better. But it's at least it gives you the abilities to export into the format that you need.
Sure.
Which that alone is worth the price of the software, whether or not you use any of the outline and chapter stuff that they offer.
Yeah. And I think outlining, I mean, I'm working on a book that I'm actually co-writing, which I've never done before. And honestly, having an outline is a really easy way to co-write something, because without that, it would just seem awkward to script something and then have my co-writer revise it or something. And then it just seems like he's editorial. And something that I started doing with Kevin on After Houdini was he likes seeing outlines, because to him, that was like the writer's equivalent of doing layouts. And because he wasn't writing the story, you know, I still wanted his input. So I would send him the outlines and he'd, you know, ask questions or comments or whatever. And it was really helpful for him to kind of think of the whole issue rather than just waiting for, you know, script pages to come in. So that's been really great. And I'm trying to do that with all the collaborators I'm working with. I send them outlines so they can see an overview of the issue. They can start thinking about it visually. It's just more productive as a collaboration.
Yeah, I think that's a really a nice way, a better way to feel like a partnership. Like you said, I never even thought of it that way, that it's basically the writer's version of layouts and thumbnails.
Yeah.
Before we lose track of time, I want to hear about your project with Dynamite, because I just talked to Paul Aller, who happens to be involved in the same project. So I know Dynamite's doing some really cool things. They have we're recording this in November, and they're doing pre-orders for some like cutesy versions of books that would never be considered cutesy before. Like, they're doing Lil Red Sonja and like Lil Evil Ernie. And they didn't relaunch Red Sonja, but they've taken Red Sonja to, you know, a much bigger, broader audience by having female creators involved. And then I heard about you and Paul are part of the Pathfinder series, which I don't actually know anything about Pathfinder.
I agree about Dynamite. Like, some of the stuff they're putting out now, like they're doing an Army of Darkness series with Steve Niles, which is exciting. And some of the titles they're bringing back are pretty cool. As far as Pathfinder, Pathfinder is a property created by Paizo, which is a tabletop RPG gaming company, very much in line with Dungeons & Dragons.
Okay.
I want to say that they produce some of those books. I'm not even sure. Don't quote me on that. But it's all very fantasy-based. And the way I got connected with that was Jim Zubkovich is writing the Pathfinder series, and he's obviously well-versed in the fantasy genre. He's doing Skull Kickers. He does a lot of D&D. I mean, the guy lives for that stuff. And he just, without me knowing, he threw my name in a hat for this kind of spin-off series involving goblin stories. Editorial there reached out to me and asked me to pitch some stories. And I had played D&D as a kid with my oldest brother, so I was familiar with it, but I wasn't an expert. So it took some kind of researching into Paizo as a company and, you know, keeping with continuity as far as characters. And, you know, there's so many different books written about goblins that, you know, I had to make sure I was going by what Paizo considers to be fact. So it was really interesting doing work for hire that way, kind of writing a licensed property, which I'd never done before. And it took about, I'd say, three pitches before Paizo said yes. The stories I sent, the editor at Dynamite liked them, but it was final approval by the company because we're representing their characters. But yeah, I finally had a story that got the thumbs up, and the process was extremely smooth. Like, I didn't have to find an artist, which was a new thing for me. So they found an artist, they put it all together, obviously. I was just responsible for the script. And, yeah, I mean, they had no notes on my 10-page story, which was I was quite surprised. And it went right into production, and, you know, I saw some the art pages as they were coming in, and then it was solicited for November. So it was a fun experience, for sure.
Is this connected to the 2007 movie called Pathfinder, or was that just...
I think that's something else, actually.
Something else? Okay, because when I had seen that there was a comic by this title, and knowing Dynamite does a lot of property-based work, I thought, well, maybe there was a chance that that's what that was from. But so you're saying it's from a tabletop?
Yeah, I think it's more in line. I think the Pathfinder film, if I'm not mistaken, was kind of more of a Nordic...
It was like a Viking kind of story.
I believe this is something different, I think. It was cool. It was cool to write a story that, you know, trying to tell, I mean, speaking of pulp with the one shot, like I had to basically tell a beginning, middle, and end story in 10 pages. So that was, even more challenging, but fun. And I would, you know, be open to doing it again if they have anything that comes up.
Was this your first anthology?
Technically, no. It is the first one that has seen print. I did an 8-page short story for Greyhaven Comics, which I was invited to do. My story was part of a much larger story, and each writer and artist were telling one perspective of this story. Basically, it's a bunch of friends that go out one night drinking, and things go horribly awry, but it's retelling the night before through the perspective of each character, and obviously each perspective is very different. That hasn't seen print, so I mean technically it's the first anthology thing I worked on, and the artist is Johnny Christmas, who's doing really well at Image.
Oh, I love him. I just love his work.
Yeah, so it was pretty cool to work with him, and but I don't know what's going on with that project, but. So yeah, I've done some anthology work, and it's fun.
It's one of the things that I've heard about when you're trying to break in is that, you know, consider doing anthologies because it's a way to get into larger books with a lot more people involved who are going to also be pushing the book. And I've done several anthology type pieces, and it's a beast.
Mm-hmm.
When you do that, but here you're with Pathfinder, you've got a much more, efficient process because the publisher's taking care of things.
Yes, and you're right. I think that doing anthology work, or just doing short stories, it's easier of a commitment for an artist if a writer's trying to find someone to collaborate with.
Right.
And it's part of something bigger. Like Rachel Deering just had a very successful. Huge Kickstarter that, just proves that, people, it's easier for even established talent to commit to a project like that because it's, it's 10 to 12 pages, nothing crazy. But, it's a culmination of lots of great stories, which, can be fun. And, anybody that's trying to break in, doing anthology work, even if you do your own anthology, I have some friends like Ed Brisson and Ryan Ferrier that have put together their own anthologies, which it serves as kind of a portfolio. Like you can show a publisher and an editor a wide range of art styles, pacing, stories, all, under the umbrella of one theme, which is also a great writing exercise. And you are producing work, you're producing a book, so you're proving that you can follow through.
We were talking about Paul Aller being also on Pathfinder, and he did the same thing with his book, Clockwork. Clockwork is a great collection of stories.
Yeah,
I'm in the middle of reading one now called Twisted Dark by Neil Gibson, and it is dark indeed. Like, I mean, to the point where I've had to put it down for a couple days. I'm like, I'm a depressed person. There's only so many depressing stories I can read. So, but yeah, he's like, he's the writer and he has these different artists throughout the stories.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I love short stories though. I mean, it's one of those things that in comics experience, that's how, we do our exercises in very short format.
Okay.
Because there's only, you know, if you're trying to read 10 scripts, you can't, you know, you can't necessarily get through 10, 22 page scripts or longer. So you sort of, you know, you need to wrangle it down to 5 pages. Or something manageable just for the review process of exercise and, you know, homework, if you will.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, and that's what pitches are mostly. They're just an excerpt of a larger story, and you want to hook somebody within 5 to 10 pages typically. So, yeah, I totally recommend, you know, short stories, anthology work for people that are trying to, you know, get into comics.
And what else do you have going on?
I have some stuff in the fire. I can't really announce any of it. One of the most recent thing I'm hoping will have an announcement maybe by the end of the month is a really cool series called Art Monster, which I guess the high concept is Art School Confidential meets Reanimator. So it's kind of a Frankenstein story, or my take on a Frankenstein story. And, you know, hopefully an announcement for that is coming at the end of the month so I can kind of share more about it. I have something lined up for next summer, which is way too early to talk about, but pretty excited about that. So, yeah, I'm hoping to have some stuff that I can officially say within the next, you know, 4 to 6 weeks.
That's good. And I know that, you know, you survived New York Comic Con. I barely did.
Yeah.
rough. Oh, gosh. I was only there for a day, and it was brutal. And then I got the plague from it that kind of wiped me out for, like, 4 weeks. And at the same time, I had other shows to get to. So are you done with your – so now that you're up there in Vermont, I don't know what the convention scene is like up there. Is there one?
It's non-existent. I mean, there are actually some creators here. Like, probably the most famous one is Alison Bechdel.
Oh, sure, yeah.
So she lives in Vermont. And, yeah, I mean, there's not really any shows. I think the closest one recently was Granite Con, which was in New Hampshire.
Right, yeah.
Which I didn't actually get to, which I'll try next year. But conventions for me, I think, are done until maybe Emerald City. The thing about conventions is that I don't have completed stories out, like trades out, so I don't really want a table because, again, selling a single issue of a larger series is kind of a waste of time, honestly.
Sure.
So, yeah, I just kind of want to – I might take a backseat to conventions unless I have a good enough reason to go and just start building up a body of work and having something substantial to present people maybe later next year.
I think it depends on the show too. Like some shows you like, New York is obviously very expensive. But there are shows that I just, you know, I don't really normally table at anything these days. I just go, and if I'm lucky, somebody who's been in, you know, also been in the same anthology or whatever will have a table, and I'll be like, okay, I'll go spend a few hours over there. But it's such a big social scene that there, I know, I guess it depends on what you'd like to go to conventions for. Some people really love panels. I haven't been to a panel in like forever.
I used to love going to panels. And that now this entire year I've been to maybe 4 or 5 shows and I didn't see a single panel because I don't know. I go there, like you say, to see friends and like, hang out and do some networking, but I'd like to go to a show and be on a panel. I think that's fun.
Yeah, it's absolutely fun.
So hopefully I can line some of that stuff up for next year.
I enjoy it. But then again, you know, I enjoy talking, and so do you. So.
Yeah. I'm never too shy to talk about comics. So.
Yeah, we've got a few more things going on down here in the New Jersey area. Actually, I'll be going to Virginia for the first time. So I will be at the Richmond, Virginia Comic Con and I will be, for the first time, having professional special effects makeup artist Brody Williams work on me.
Whoa.
And he is going to make me demonic.
Wow.
We're doing this for the Dead Irons comic, which was actually out through Dynamite a few years ago. So Jim Kohark is booth babing to the extent of I'm going to supposedly look scary as hell. not so babe like.
That sounds cool. I didn't even know Virginia had. I guess every state really now kind of is having some kind of convention getting in on the comic books.
Yeah, they're getting there. I mean, there's a new one coming up in New Jersey in December that I will be at helping out a friend's table.
So, where in New Jersey?
A town called Hamilton, which I have no idea where that is. I believe it's somewhere in the South Jersey area. It might be not far from Philly or not far from like Princeton, that area.
Gotcha.
And we've got steampunk shows, though. We always have something going on there.
Yeah.
There's always like steampunk shows. And in February is the combined two like sister shows going on in hotels that are next to each other, the Wicked Fair and Voltaire's Necro Comic Con.
Oh, wow.
And so it's like a goth comic fantasy scene all together at once with, you know, those shows are always like filled with musicians and food, like all sorts of like they'll have drink tastings and costumes everywhere. And they're not even costumes. I mean, this is just like, these are the wardrobes that people finally feel like they can wear. Not really. And it's like, oh, we just can't wear these things to our day jobs, but these are our clothes.
That's awesome.
So that's the kind of stuff that goes on here. And I really look forward to that. And, you know, maybe they'll have a fashion show or something, because sometimes they pull out a fashion show, and those are great.
That sounds great. That's awesome.
Yeah. So I don't know if there's ever any coaxing to get people to New Jersey. You're so far now, Jeremy.
I know. I mean, I actually have relatives in New Jersey. My grandparents are there, so I don't go as often as my mom says I should.
Of course.
But, yeah, I mean, there's plenty of reasons for me to hit up Jersey.
Do you have a local comic shop?
I don't, which is frustrating, honestly. There's a shop in Burlington, which is about an hour north of me. I set up a pull list. I went in. I was planning to just go once a month, and I go in, and nothing was pulled for me. And they're like, oh, we got nothing for you. I was like, okay. So I go over to the new releases. And all the books are right there on the shelf. And I'm like, really?
That's interesting.
I was just like, you know what? I'm not going to. There's no reason for me to come an hour for you to do something that you don't do.
Right.
So, yeah. So I had my old shop in Brooklyn. The owner, Gary, was awesome at Brooklyn Comics and More. And he would mail me my pull list, which was awesome.
Yeah,
and
we did that at Comic Fusion, too. We have a mail list.
Yeah, and I actually did a signing for Pulp at the shop during New York Comic Con the week leading up to the weekend, and he told me that the shop was closing.
No.
Yeah. So it was really kind of a shock because we had the signing on a Wednesday. I ran into him at New York Comic Con on Thursday, and he's like, "Hey, I thought I should let you know now that you're the last signing." I was like, "Oh, are you like diversifying or what's going on?" He's like, "No, we're closing." I was like, "What?" So that was, and I think they closed maybe a week ago. So they actually closed on the day of, I think, like a 5-year or 7-year anniversary or something.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, apparently his business partner was in doing some shady activity, which kind of ruined the business.
That's such a shame, because Brooklyn is such a huge base.
I know,
and the Promise people.
What was even more heartbreaking was, you know, he found it frustrating the shop was closing, but really, the shop where it is in South Slope it's literally half a block away from a public school. And these kids come in every Wednesday for their books, and that's what killed them the most, was just not having a place for kids, you know, a fun, safe place to hang out, read comics, get into it, and that's, you know, going away, which is really, really, really disappointing.
Wow. Well, I think, is Bergen Street in Brooklyn, or is that in Manhattan? I don't remember.
No, that's in Brooklyn. That's in Prospect Heights.
Okay.
And that shop's doing really well.
Yeah, that's a beautiful, nice store. Great people that run it, and a lot of social activity as well, as far as like having signings and events and stuff.
Yeah, and I really think a lot of shops, you know, that don't do it should do it, because I mean, like Third Eye Comics is a great shop that just, you know, Collector's Corner, these places that just do it right. Like they invite, Bergen Street's one of them. Like that's how I got to know so many people when I was living in New York, was just going to the release parties at Bergen Street, and Tom and Amy and Tucker are just awesome, and they would just introduce me to whoever was signing and introduce me as a friend of the shop and a fellow writer, and that's how I've made some really great friendships with some established people.
Yeah, we try to do what we can for Comic Fusion to get creators in and have signings, and it's usually only going to be successful if there's a larger reason, like Free Comic Book Day and our big charity event, Superhero Weekend, because then we know that people are coming in specifically for that, because we've done signings where we've just said, hey, come on in and we'll do like a noir day, and we'll have like, you know, three or four noir comics writers and artists and stuff in, and you know, inevitably what happens is their own friends and family show up, and that's, you know, like, you know, we can't, it's, I don't know if it's a location thing, or I don't know if we have trouble publicizing, because I feel like I, you know, just run my mouth all the time about the shop. So, I'm not quite sure what it is, but it might just be that we're in the middle of Nowhereville, New Jersey, you know?
Gotcha.
But Wild Pig, we always have fun there too. Wild Pig does fun signings and events, and Bill Ellis, who's an artist and creator, is managing their social activity, if you will. That's in a whole different part of Jersey where it's more populated and might be easier to get to as far as transit and stuff goes.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, but Wild Pig is just, again, great, fun group of people. And they do the most amazing sales twice a year, 50% off sales.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, on trades. Like, it doesn't matter. There's just racks and racks of trades that are 50%.
That's awesome.
So that's what I do. That's when I do my shopping. Like, if I'm not getting it digitally, I take, like, $100 to Wild Pig. And then I come home with a trunk full of books, and that lasts me usually a year or more because I'm such a slow reader.
Yeah, I actually, because I don't have a shop, I haven't been keeping up with anything. Like, I think I'm going to have to just break down and get an iPad just so I can read things on Comixology.
Yeah, because I have a Kindle, and it really is helpful. I mean, sometimes I'll just, if I'm not writing while I'm, you know, have a slow moment at work, I'll download PDFs, and it's usually stuff that, you know, people want to send me review copies and stuff. So, I read a lot of review copies, and it's just, you know, alt-tabbing back and forth between work and reading a page or something like that.
Sure.
And you can do it on the Kindle, but I actually, I'm constantly zooming. Pinching in and pinching out to read the captions and stuff. And it gets a little tedious on a device that small.
Sure.
But, whatever. It's convenient because I can sit in bed with that, and it's very convenient.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. Is like I do love printed copies, but to get a hold of them is problematic, and I don't really want to wait for trades, honestly, because I like supporting creators when they have books coming out, because
it's just, and they keep going.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, my brother got an iPad Mini, and I was reading a comic on it, and I was actually pretty impressed, even though it's a smaller device. You know, you can hold it in one hand, and the pages, actually, I can read an entire page without having to zoom. Mm-hmm. So maybe I'll have to figure something out about getting that so I can get my comics fixed, because I'm so behind.
What kind of stuff are you reading these days?
I guess the last thing I read was, I read the trade paperback of Nick Spencer and Riley Rossmo's Bedlam. And before that, I've been buying a lot of like trades and graphic novels through Amazon just because it's convenient. And Sacrifice, Sam Humphries and Dalton Rose's Sacrifice through Dark Horse was phenomenal. There are a couple independent titles that friends of mine that run Orbital Comics in London recommended some really great indie titles. So I picked it. One is, I'm forgetting. I don't even think I can say the. I forget the title. It's a pretty long title, but I think it was put out through Fantagraphics. But yeah, just recommendations at this point. Haven't really followed up with single issues. Like, I really want, I love Saga, and I'm just waiting for the next trade to come out because I'm so far behind on the single issue, so.
Right.
It's just kind of frustrating.
You can sort of, like, get a bigger chunk in one sitting.
Yeah, and I'm actually kind of impressed that with comics, people don't really spoil comics through Twitter or Facebook. Like, I have friends that have ruined TV shows and movies for me, but
oh yeah, I've had the networks ruin it. I mean, like, they don't even wait 24 hours and they're talking about their own show. I'm just like, God damn you, Castle people.
Yeah, seriously, and I'm impressed that even though I haven't picked up the last four or five issues of Saga, I don't feel like anything's been spoiled. I think a couple of people spoiled Gravity for me recently, and I haven't seen it. And I the last 2 weekends, I'm like, I'm going to go see Gravity. I'm going to go see it, and I don't see it. And then I read something someone posted on Facebook, and I'm like, damn it.
Oh.
So.
Well, let's see. I did read the first issue for Pretty Deadly.
Oh, I haven't read that. That's
It's very good. I was not sure I was going to get through it because this I will spoil only because I think of it more as a warning. By page 2, there's a little bunny getting his brains blown out, and it's like,
wow.
And I mean, like, the Emma Rios, right, is the artist.
Yeah.
Phenomenally gorgeous book.
Oh,
and yet page 2 is this giant picture of a bunny's brains being blown out. And I was just like, ready. I mean, like, I'm a vegetarian, folks, if y'all don't know that by now. And I'm on Twitter, and I'm like, oh, my God, really? I really want to read this book. I want to love this book. And I got through it, and it was fantastic. So so it does get a recommendation despite page 2. And like I said, I was reading this this very large collection of short stories called Twisted Dark by Neil Gibson. Death Sentence by Monte Nero is from Titan Comics. Titan's a great publisher.
I've been hearing about them, actually.
Wow, they do some really cool stuff, and they're London based. So
yep.
It's funny. I went to a party and I was just like meeting everybody, and I'm like, you're all from not here. Like, I'm in New York. I'm like, you're all from London. Let's see, what else? There's a book called Sanctuary that the author contacted me. It was a 7-part comic talking about animals and animal rights and stuff like that. And it's very heavily about animal testing. So,
oh, wow.
But it was a very cartoony style. Like, mm-hmm. You were talking about cartoony, and I agree. I don't think pulp and Chris's work, I would call that cartoony because it's not, like, Disney-fied.
Yeah, there's nuances in, like, facial expressions that he just...
Yeah. So Stephen Coughlin's book, Sanctuary, is, I would say, a cartoonier version of, serious subject matter, but I'll have to have him on the show to figure out where people will be able to get that. Lone Ranger, of course, always reading.
Oh, nice. The book that I was mentioning earlier, I think it's called The End of the Fucking World.
Oh, that's so funny, because that's what Paul was just recommending.
Oh, my God, that thing is a page-turner. I've always been fascinated with serial killers. Not that this is spoiling the book, but it has that same, like, I mean, it is a violent book, but in a way that is just so disturbing. And you because of the style, you're not thinking it's going to go in that direction at all. And I sat down and I was reading it, and I was just, within 10 pages, I was like, what am I reading? And before I knew it, I finished it. And I was just like, I'm going to read this again because this just totally knocked my socks off. People need to be picking up that book. That thing is amazing. Because I think it was originally serialized. I forget. I think the guy, I hate that I forget the guy's name, but he... I think was self-publishing it through some publisher he had established.
Well, yeah, that was like Oily Comics or something.
Yeah, Oily Comics, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, I guess it's going out through Fantagraphics or something now.
Yeah, it's really, really great, really great.
So let's say, oh, so I started to write down the comics and books and stuff that I read. So that way by the end of the year, I can look back and see what I actually got through. Doc Unknown by Fabian Reinhart.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I'm so, and he did a Kickstarter for the Boss Snake one shot. Yeah. And I love it. And along those sort of same, you know, pulpy lines, like, you know, Doc Unknown and your book Pulp is Action Labs got a book out called Jack Hammer.
Oh, sweet.
Love it. Absolutely love it. Velvet, of course, Brubaker and Epting.
Oh, is it good? Like, I've been hearing some things.
Yeah, I honestly, I feel terrible because I have a bunch of Brubaker books on my shelf that I've never gotten to.
Yeah.
So this was the first noir book of his that I read ever. And
have you read Fatale?
No, it's sitting on my shelf.
Oh, you got to read that.
Yeah, I know, exactly. And so it's sort of like a James Bond with a female lead.
Cool.
So Tabitha actually is another Neil Gibson comic, and that had an interesting story. You were talking about how you were working on a story about a group of people together and different points of view and stuff, and Tabitha is about a group of kids, well, not kids, but, you know, young people. And they get sort of brought into this terrible serial killer type situation.
Really?
Yeah. So, and Mixtape, I had Brad Abraham on the show and had a great time talking to him in New York. So Mixtape is another big recommendation, a lot of fun, because it's, same sort of premise, you know, like these different people that are involved in each other's lives, and then you get to see their own individual stories, and he ties it together with, you know, 90s music.
Nice. That sounds like something I would absolutely read.
Yeah, so there's so we got quite a rundown of comics for each other and for you guys listening to check out. All right, Jeremy, anything else before I let you go?
No, I think that's it. I think thank you for having me. This is, as always, a lot of fun.
So, should people be following you on Twitter? Is that the easiest place?
Twitter is the easiest. It's just @Jeremy_Holt. I update a Tumblr. I didn't really know what Tumblr was, and Kelly Sue DeConnick was really pushing me to get a Tumblr. She's like, it's so visual, and anything you post, you know, if I repost it, it goes out to like 20,000 people. I'm like, what are you talking about? That sounds crazy. So I do have a Tumblr that I'm periodically updating, which is, I don't know how someone follows a Tumblr, but it's just Clump of Trees, which is also my website, my blog. So, yeah.
Yeah, I don't like Tumblr as much, but I have it set up just for the podcast so that new episodes go there.
Oh, nice.
But, yeah, I don't really like Tumblr.
I kind of get it, and it's like, it's kind of like Twitter, I guess, but more visible.
Kind of. Yeah, exactly. It's,
I don't know, the functionality to me, the website doesn't really make sense to me. Like, I try to add things or change things or, I don't know,
Yeah, I had a hard time with it.
Yeah.
I mean, Twitter's, when you see 16 retweets of something, you're like, you know, okay, but on Tumblr, for some reason, all the reblogs, a lot of times the source gets lost.
Oh.
So you don't know where things originally came from, and if it is something visual, you know, artistic or like a photo or a comic or something like that, the point is you want people to get back to it, to you,
yeah,
to learn more, and that doesn't seem to really happen. But a lot of people use Tumblr just for their own creative purposes, like, you know, some people write their poetry on Tumblr and it gets reblogged or whatever.
Oh, I see.
And that's fun. But I know that I follow you easily on Twitter.
Likewise.
So, and speaking of, you can follow me at Elizabeth Amber, and of course the rest of the information is at amberunmasked.com. Not always safe for work, but but there you have it. Look for me at the Virginia Comic Con, and then I will be at the Hamilton, New Jersey Comic Con in December. And then moving on to Voltaire's Necrocomicon. So, crazy stuff going on here. Jeremy, thanks again.
Thank you so much.
All right, everybody. Have a great day. Cheers.